This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 85. Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we recap the Missoula Marathon in beautiful Missoula, Montana. Plus, we'll talk about how to train for a race at altitude. And for this episode's quick tip, we're going to tell you the one item that's small but so vital to every marathon you run. And if you want to get our help in your training for a half or full marathon, find out how to become a member of the Academy by visiting marathontrainingacademy.com. Well, all right, Angie, good to be here with you behind the microphone. We are on vacation. We're actually in Washington State visiting my folks, but we've been on the road for a couple weeks now. It's been nice. It's good to be in some cooler weather out here on the coast. What do you think? Has this vacation been relaxing so far or what?
Well, as relaxing as traveling with three kids and your mother can be. No, it's been really nice. But, you know, living out of a suitcase and driving long distances in a car can be a little bit wearing.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been totally a vacation for me because I'm still working with my personal coaching clients, so I can't let them down while I'm on the road enjoying myself.
But how many times have you had to cook in the last 2 weeks?
You're right. I have not had to cook or clean very much, so.
That sounds like a vacation to me.
Definitely.
We're recording this in the middle of July, and there's a couple big ultra marathons that just got over with, like the Western States 100-mile endurance run. In California, it's the most prestigious ultra marathon. It goes from Squaw Valley to Auburn, California. I always enjoy, you know, following these races.
Definitely.
It's kind of like the Super Bowl of ultra running. The champion for this year was, for the men, Timothy Olson, who finished in 15 hours and 17 minutes. And for the women, Pam Smith, who finished in 18 hours and 37 minutes. And apparently it was a really hot year. I think the temperatures got up to 102.
Wow.
It's the second hottest Western States in their 40-year history.
I can hardly run 4 miles in 100-degree weather.
So I guess there was 383 people who started the race and 277 who finished, so about a 72% finish rate.
And you have to qualify for this race. It's like a lottery where you have to qualify for it, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, you have to.
So they don't just let anyone like you or me into the race. You have to have like your credentials in place.
Yeah, some of the best runners, you know, are there, ultra runners. That's why it's so fun to watch every year. So if you finish under 24 hours, you get a silver belt buckle, and that's the really coveted finishing time. And there was 95 people who finished in under 24 hours. And there was a course record set, even though it was very hot this year, by Mike Morton. Kind of a well-known ultra runner. He's 41 years old, and he set the new male masters course record. And also, just something interesting, this the female champion, Pam Smith, I don't think was really even in the short list of who was going to win this year.
You she know? Wasn't on anyone's radar?
No.
Wow.
I even heard that there was, you know, a little production company that's going to make a movie about this year's Western States and kind of more focus on the women's race. And you know, Pam Smith kind of came out of nowhere, won the race, and so they had to do fake pre-race interviews with her after the fact. So she had to pretend like the race had not even happened yet, and she was just going in hoping to do her best.
Like dab the sweat off her face.
Yeah, even though she'd already won it, you know, and knew how it went.
Oh my goodness. That's a great story.
Also, the Badwater 135 Ultra Marathon through Death Valley in California just finished, and the winner was Carlos Alberto Gomez de Sá of Portugal. He's 39 years old. He finished in 24 hours, 38 minutes, and 16 seconds. For the female, top finisher was Catherine Todd of Australia, age 34. She finished in 29 hours, 55 minutes, 29 seconds. And some of the greatest ultra runners in the world go there as well. Some of the other finishers, people who you might have heard of this year were Pam Reed. She finished 13th place. Dean Karnazes finished 17th. David Goggins at 18th. Marshall Ulrich, who we've interviewed on the podcast, finished 53rd. And that was his 19th crossing of the Badwater Ultra Marathon.
Wow. Can't imagine.
And Lisa Smith-Batchen, who we've interviewed this year, she was going to go for a Badwater quad, and unfortunately she had to drop out due to excruciating sciatic pain. So
it sounds like it was a tough decision for her, but she made the best decision for her health and decided not to be unwise about it. But I'm sure that's got to be difficult.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of news here for you on this episode. Angie, do you have any word from the community?
Yeah, I thought I would share a couple emails that I got. One is from Chris. He's a personal coaching client from Pennsylvania, and he's trying to qualify for Boston in September. And just a quick quote from an email that I got from him this week. He said, "Last week went pretty well. I ran the fastest mile I ever have in my life on Tuesday. I was mentally beating myself up before my workout about having to do mile repeats that fast. So I decided for the first mile I would run hard and not look at my watch until I was done. Well, I ran it in 5 minutes 32 seconds. I was super excited because the fastest mile I ever ran was 5:58 in high school." And so I just thought that was a really neat milestone for him. You know, sometimes you can really go into a speed workout just dreading it. But if you can put that behind you and just go out and do your best, you know, sometimes you can really set new milestones and surprise yourself.
Yeah, definitely. That's a fast mile.
That's very fast. So keep up the good work, Chris. And the second email comes from Jody. She says, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. For starters, I love your podcast. Usually I listen to them on easy runs or while traveling. I especially appreciate all the research Angie put into the recent podcast on bonking. Yesterday I ran my fourth marathon. In the previous three, I hit the wall pretty hard around mile 20 to 21. I knew it was a fueling issue, but I wasn't sure how to fix it. After listening to this podcast, I decided to up my fueling intake to around 200 calories per hour, which seemed like too much until I heard the research Angie did and I figured I'd give it a try. And it worked. Yesterday, I finished my fourth marathon in 3 hours, 48 minutes, a PR by 13 minutes, and the last 6 miles were the fastest of the entire race. I really appreciate all you do. Keep it up."
Well, congratulations, Jody, on your fourth marathon and that good PR. And we're glad the podcast was a help to you.
That's right. This message comes from Brian, and he is from Bozeman, Montana. And we actually met up with him at the starting line area. He came up to us and said, "Hey, are you Angie and Trevor?" And we're like, "Yeah, we are." And we got to visit with him and found out that he was running his first marathon and a listener of our podcast. So I wanted to share his experience from the Missoula Marathon in his own words here. He says, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. I met you both at the start of the Missoula Marathon. Hope you both enjoyed it as much as I did. Absolutely beautiful morning. I've been a listener for the past 3.5 months and have enjoyed every minute of your podcasts. I tried fasting 3 hours before the race, despite some of my marathon friends' negative opinions. I had an awesome first marathon thanks to the both of you and the guests you've had on the podcast. Slow and steady was a good pace for me, and I felt pretty good the whole way. I got to mile 20, and I couldn't believe the amount of people who are walking. I started passing people and had absolutely no energy issue at all. I finished strong, I think, based on the nutrition expert advice on your podcast. I talked with some incredible runners along the way. I felt honored to run alongside and talk with a 72-year-old runner who had over 300 marathons under his belt. Another runner I had the privilege of running alongside was on his 98th marathon in 98 weeks. He's traveled all over the world because of his love for the race. He told me, 'Always run for the health of it.' I saw him later at the finish line, and he told me, 'Now that you've done a marathon, you can do anything. You'll see yourself in a different way. Have more confidence to take on life's everyday challenges and handle them with ease.' He also told me that the marathon teaches you patience. He is very right. I can't believe I'm already thinking about doing another one after only one day. My finishing time was 4 hours and 56 minutes. Next one, I'd like to better my time and follow one-year plans. You two are great, and I can't thank you enough for all the informative and inspirational podcasts. Brian." And he says, "P.S., you were right. The back of the pack is a lot of fun."
Well, congratulations, Brian, on completing your first marathon, and it's awesome to get that race report in time for this episode and how we got to meet him there right before the cannons went off for the start of the race. And if you ever see us at a marathon, just come on up and say hi. We would love to meet you. And if you see people that look like us and you're not sure if it's us or not, just come up and say hi anyway.
That's right.
It might be us.
You'll either be right or you'll feel awkward. But if you say hi to us, we'll try not to make you feel awkward.
Oh, yeah.
We're really pretty nice.
We are super nice people.
Trevor will, like, give you a big old hug.
Well, probably not. I don't want to get too awkward, but we're going to be at the Tupelo Marathon and the Air Force Marathon in Dayton. So if you're going to be at one of those races and happen to see us, yeah, please come on up and introduce yourself. Angie usually wears her bright yellow Marathon Maniac shirt.
That's right.
And a black running skirt.
That's me.
And I am the handsome guy standing next to her.
Hopefully.
I better be. And from the Academy, we want to say congratulations to Christy from North Dakota, who finished the Missoula Marathon and set a PR for herself. And we got to meet up with her at the Race Expo, and it was terrific being able to meet her. And we actually saw her at the starting line. We didn't really talk because she was kind of saw her at the last second before the cannons went off. And she was looking so focused, you know. She was ready to go out there and run strong, and she did. She didn't quite get the exact time she wanted, but she finished in, what was it, three?
3 hours and 45 minutes.
So, yeah, faster than I can. So.
She smoked both of us.
So if you want to see a picture of us with Christy at the Missoula Expo, go over to our website, and we have pictures galore over there of this whole vacation.
We do?
Well, we will.
We will, okay. I was like, what do you have in mind?
We've been taking lots of pictures. So
we have, yes.
So we'll put them up there. So.
After I carefully edit the ones I want to be seen. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way.
Now it is time for another one of our world-famous race recaps. And I've been told that people actually enjoy these recaps.
I guess, you know, sometimes it's fun to live vicariously and hear about a race that you might be considering doing or maybe you've actually done, and it's fun to hear another person's perspective of it.
So we'll try to put you right there on the course with us.
Blow by blow. Yes. Sweat droplet by sweat droplet.
Hopefully you can learn. And something that'll be helpful to you in your training. So let's start off by saying this was a marathon that we kind of did incorporated as part of our vacation, which is an awesome way, I think, to spend vacation is to do a race. Your fitness doesn't totally go into the tank if you run a marathon during vacation. So we came to Montana to see Angie's family, her dad, her brother, did the Missoula Marathon. Now we're here in Washington State. All total, round trip, we're going to be driving about 5,000 miles.
With three small kids.
Yeah, and thankfully our kids are good travelers, and we've been able to do a lot of cool things. We've been able to climb some mountains before the marathon, which is probably not the best way to spend your days tapering before a race.
Right, especially if it's a race that you're looking for, have a time goal. And so we were, you know, going into this race more as just a fun race.
Right.
But we did do a significant amount of hiking, so.
So we wanted a sufficient excuse for running slow races, so that's our excuse. We were hiking in mountains too much.
That's right.
So we've wanted to do the Missoula Marathon for a long time, and as most of you probably know, Angie's trying to run a marathon all 50 states. So now we have Montana crossed off the list. And how many have you done now?
Let me see. That was Marathon 17 and State 13.
Right on. Angie and I both have been to Missoula quite a few times, but I feel like I really got a sense for the city this time, actually staying in it and, you know, running it and walking around. Missoula is in western Montana in the mountains, and it's kind of settled in the middle of five different valleys. So five different valleys come together, and I think the Clark Fork River flows through. We've got great weather in the summertime, so it's cool to be able to run a marathon in July.
And not totally die of the heat.
Yeah.
Yeah, the great thing about Montana in the summer is it's usually cool in the morning, and then it warms up nicely during the day, and so it's not just miserable like Missouri is.
And people were telling me that it could get up to 100 degrees. Like, sometimes it's hot for the Missoula Marathon. And it starts at 6 in the morning, but weather was pleasant, didn't get too hot. We got done by about 10, so.
Ish.
10-ish. So Missoula is one of the biggest cities in Montana, and I think it started out as like a logging town. And in the 1800s, there was kind of a well-connected politician in Deer Lodge, Montana, who, I was reading that because of him, the town of Deer Lodge was given a choice between whether they were going to get the state prison or the state university. And it was the late 1800s, and I guess they didn't really see a lot of potential in having a university, so they opted for the prison. And Missoula got the university. And how did that choice work out for him in the end? Well, having been to Deer Lodge and Missoula, I would rather live in Missoula. But that was kind of interesting. It's got a nice downtown, you know, a big outdoor emphasis. There's trails and water sports and snow skiing. And from what I've learned now, a very healthy running community.
That's right.
So let's talk about the Race Expo, first of all.
Yeah, it was a small but well-organized expo. They had it in Karis Park, kind of under a big pavilion-like tent. And so it kind of had that outdoor vibe to it. Of course, it was a nice warm day, so it was fun to be outside. It was right next to a nice park, and so our kids were able to play, and we were able to get our race packets and look around at different booths. And
so Karis Park has a huge carousel that kids were able to ride. And we met up with some friends when we were there. My buddy Aubrey ran his very first half marathon in 1 hour and 52 minutes. And unfortunately, we didn't get to run together because the half marathon started at a different point than the full marathon. But it's been fun just watching him train up for it. And we've done a couple training runs together. He and his family actually live in Billings. So I thought the expo was everything expo ought to be, you know. Convenient and nice t-shirt, easy packet pickup.
But it's always fun at the expos, you know, you start seeing fit, healthy looking people, and It's kind of neat to see different race t-shirts of races you've done before.
Yeah.
Like, hey, that, you have that shirt, you know, or I have that shirt, whatever. When we had announced that we were doing the Missoula Marathon on the podcast, I got an email from a listener named Jill, and she offered the use of their rental house in downtown Missoula. Of course, we were glad to take her up on that offer, and just a really nice little house downtown that was really close to where the buses picked us up to take us to the starting line. So it was very convenient and comfortable. And it was, you know, really fun to be able to meet her and her family.
Yeah, it was great. So we appreciate that, Jill, if you're listening to this episode. And I thought it was great to be able to walk to the place where the buses left to go to the starting line and then walk back to the house at the finishing line, not have to worry about parking or any of that.
Yeah, it worked out really well logistic-wise.
Yes.
Because we had to get up at 4 a.m. on race morning. Because it started at 6, and the buses ran from 4:15 to 5:15 a.m. So we didn't want to be on the last bus or miss the bus. So we got down there at about 5 a.m., I think.
You know, getting up at 4 a.m. is just not my cup of tea, really. And how do you sleep well the night before knowing that you got to get up at 4 a.m.? Maybe some people are used to doing it, you know, for work or for their commute, but I'm not. How did you sleep the night before?
I slept fine. It was just too short, as usual. It's hard to get to bed at a decent time, especially when you're on vacation. So,
right.
Yeah, but yeah, it was fine. We were able to just get dressed and
go through our little morning routine.
That's right.
Which, by the way, maybe we ought to go over. We talked about briefly going over what our morning routine looks like on the day of a race. So, Angie, tell us, by the time your alarm clock goes off, and you hit snooze for like the fifth time and you get out of bed.
I think you're thinking of someone else. This Angie doesn't snooze.
So if you have 45 minutes before you got to leave the house, what does your morning routine look like?
Well, it usually starts the night before, where I locate my shoes, put the timing chip or whatever type of timing apparatus they have on your shoe, pin your bib to your race shirt. But, you know, just get together everything you're going to need for the race. Hat, watch, make sure your running watch is charged if you run with a watch. And, you know, make a little pile because, you know, if you're traveling with people, you want to, like, turn on all the lights and wake up everyone in the room at 4 a.m.
Or when you're up in the morning and your brain is not totally all functioning, you don't want to try to get all that stuff together. You probably forget an important thing.
Exactly. And if you're going to check a gear bag, make sure you have that packed with things that you're going to need with, you know, your name on it or whatever the regulations of the race are. So basically, you know, try to make it dummy proof for race morning or brain fog proof, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So yeah, I basically just stumble out of bed when my alarm clock goes off, drink a glass of water, go use the bathroom, and then, you know, start putting your running gear on. Make sure you use Body Glide or whatever you use in the places you need it, which can vary. And get everything together. And Trevor and I don't eat pre-race, so that makes it a lot easier for us. We usually just drink fluids. He has his coffee. I drink lots of water. use the bathroom a couple of times to try to empty things out.
That's it. Just keeping it simple.
That's right.
I think that's what you want to do.
Right. And it helps just to have that routine so that you don't have another anxiety to worry about. Because sometimes you're a new area and you're thinking, oh, we got to get there on time and find the right place. You know, just have that simple morning routine down so you don't have to second guess it, basically.
Right on. So let's talk about race day. When race day itself came on Sunday, July the 14th, we left the house after going through our morning routine, and we started walking to where the shuttle buses were going to pick us up, which we didn't really have a clear idea where they were. We just had a map to follow. But it was pretty easy because after a couple blocks, we started seeing runners everywhere.
It's like, follow the zombie runners. You know, everyone's kind of like stumbling around half asleep. And it was very well organized. I mean, they had clear signs pointing to the buses for the half marathon and the full marathon. And so we just kind of got in line. And it was really cool because a couple of maniacs had like a little table set up with various drink items on there. And I recognized a guy I'd met at the Go St. Louis Marathon, Dennis. And so said hi to him and made small talk as we waited in line to get on the bus.
We saw a lot of people that we recognized at this race.
It is funny. You know, the marathon community is fairly small. And once you start going to a few races, you start recognizing people. Like, hey, there's Maniac Larry, and there's, you know, whoever you recognize.
Especially among marathon maniacs.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really neat to be part of a running community. I guess that's, you know, one of the payoff factors for me is just being able to experience it and see people that you know and things like that. So the buses took us for the full marathon out to Frenchtown, Montana.
And it was fairly cool in the morning, and I didn't have a throwaway shirt, so I just had my short shorts and my t-shirt. So I was enjoying that warm bus ride. I didn't want to get off the bus.
But the time came, we had to get off the bus. And
yeah, so we reluctantly got off.
Got in line and used the porta pots. And Trevor took so long in there, I thought he had fallen in.
It was like, I know, I felt bad.
I was thinking, did I miss him come out somewhere? I don't see him. Like, whoa. standing there.
You know, something cool that they had at the starting line was fireworks. They had fireworks that would go off, you know, counting down from like 15 to 10 to 5. And then a huge fireworks display at the start of the marathon.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was like the 4th of July in the sky as you're starting the race.
Yeah, so you have to kind of run and look back over your shoulder at the fireworks.
Yeah, it was neat. It was like, wow, this is one of those benchmarks that other races are going to have to exceed now. You know? Like, wow, never had fireworks at the start. So that was pretty cool. They didn't have a wave start, but there was 1,500 marathoners and 3,500 half marathoners. So it wasn't terribly crowded.
No, because the half marathoner started at a different place.
Exactly.
All right, so let's talk about the course itself. After the fireworks went off and we got going, Angie, what'd you think about the course?
Well, it started in some, you know, kind of beautiful countryside. You could see the mountains and the valley and, you know, of course, the sun starting to rise. And, you know, so it was really beautiful. Saw a lot of nice houses and cabins and horses and other farm animals. There wasn't a ton of spectators during the first few miles because we were kind of winding back towards Missoula. So, you know, it's not a marathon to expect a ton of crowd support.
Well, not in the beginning, but the closer we got to Missoula, the more and more people were out.
Yeah.
And I thought I had good spectatorship.
Yeah, it was. The course was only partially closed, and there was, you know, police escort and everything. So there was very little traffic along the road as well. So it was a really good course. And it was, you know, fairly flat too, until you got to about mile 13, and there was a few hills at that point.
Including one very long hill.
Yes. Trevor and I ran together for the first half, and then at the hill, I was like, just leave me, just go.
Yeah, you wanted to walk the hill, so.
I did. Well, my body wanted me to walk the hill.
Yes, what was going on?
Well, for some reason, I just didn't feel like I was getting as much oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't been training on hills or anything. So I think, I don't know, it's just something, my body was not responding well, and I was having some hamstring pain. So I knew that if I were to push at that point, I would probably be very miserable later on. And I was fine.
I think after we got past the hill and we got closer and closer to Missoula, there were kind of mountain cabin properties and people on horseback who were out there and people who were out there just kicking it in their lawn chairs, playing music for us. Or there's quite a few people that had their garden hose set up where it was spraying mist, and you could run through the mist and kind of get cooled down if you want. There probably must have been like 10 people who did that.
Yeah, it was really neat. I've really never seen a race that had so many people who did that just on a private basis, really.
And probably the coolest thing is we ran by a house where they had a baby grand piano in the front yard on the lawn, and a guy in a tuxedo sitting there playing the piano.
It was really neat. He was playing Chariots of Fire. Da 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 da. No one wants to hear me sing it, but any runner can, you know, just swells your heart to hear Chariots of Fire.
Doesn't that song make you want to slow down and run in slow motion?
I don't know. It kind of makes me well up with emotion. Maybe I'm weird, but
yeah,
I've always liked that song.
But apparently that guy does that every year.
He does. Plays for the whole duration of the marathon. So.
Like 6 hours he's out there.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's cool. Another thing that happened to us along the course is we met another one of our listeners, Jeff from Great Falls, Montana. He pulled up alongside of us and introduced himself, said that he's been listening since episode 10.
It's a long time.
Yeah, and I think that was his fourth marathon there in Missoula he was doing, and was just really thankful for the podcast and just a real friendly guy. So, and I later met up with him again on the course. He got ahead of me, and then we met back up, and I ran with him for a little while, and we got to talking and had a pretty good conversation, ran together for a mile or a mile and a half. So
that's neat. Yeah, so if you see us out there in a marathon, don't hesitate to come up and introduce yourself and visit.
Yeah, yeah, we would love to say hi to you. So if you see us, please flag us down. And if you see people that look like us, and just go up to them and say, hey, are you Angie and Trevor? And all they could say is no or yes, right? So.
And then you'll either feel happy or awkward.
No, but Angie's always wearing her Marathon Maniacs t-shirt, right?
Yeah, I pretty much always wear Marathon Maniacs. And usually in the warmer weather, a running skirt, so.
Right. So what did you think about the aid stations?
Yeah, I thought they were really good. For the first half of the course, I think they were about every 2 miles. And they were well-stocked. You know, volunteers were friendly and competent. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of spectators during that first half, but the aid stations were very enthusiastic. And then after the half, I think they're every mile. Yeah, and then actually the lady whose house we were staying in, she and her husband were manning the very last aid station. So that was kind of cool.
And the last aid station was like at mile 25.
Right.
So I didn't even stop at that one. I just kind of ran by and said hi to him. But yeah, all the way up to the end, they had good aid stations and plenty of encouragement.
Yeah, it was good. And I also saw a lady along the course who I had met at the Hatfield-McCoy Marathon. She ran by and she's like, hey, I know you. And I was like, yeah, we talked at the finishing line area there. So it was really cool to see her again.
Yeah, so this is a small world. You know, you just see people and there's a lot of overlap, people who've done races that we've done. And it's like I said, the longer we do this, the more we're going to be seeing the same folks, I think, which is cool.
It is, definitely.
Okay, so let's talk about the finishing area. I was able to not stop for the last mile and a half, which I was pretty happy because I did take some walk breaks before that. Probably about mile 22. I was really feeling it in my legs, and so I would take a walk break at every aid station. And I wasn't really going for a vigorous time goal or anything. But last mile came, the 4:15 pace group caught up to me, and I decided I was not going to let them finish before me. So I was actually able to run and finish in 4 hours and 14 minutes.
Awesome. That was really good. I thought you would be a little bit further ahead of me. Because you seemed a lot stronger when we parted ways, but that's still very good.
Yeah, if I didn't take those walk breaks, I probably would have finished a little quicker, but yes. I'm pretty happy at 4:14. I think this is my fourth marathon now. My fastest time is 3:55, or is it 3:54? I forget. Mm-hmm. 3:54. My slowest time is like 5 hours.
And 8 minutes. 7 minutes.
So, you know, it is getting easier. It's still not easy, but it's getting easier. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Yes, it does.
So we got another race coming up in September, like September 1st, in Tupelo, Mississippi. And I'm looking forward to it. You know, if we had a marathon to do in August, I would totally sign up and go out and do it.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things that your body gets used to it. Doesn't mean you're going to have a fast finishing time every time. You know, your goals may be different for every marathon. But, yeah, your body eventually kind of knows what it's doing. And you'll notice that the experience is easier and more enjoyable. And then the recovery is easier as well, too. So I finished in 4:22, which obviously is not my best time. But I had a lot of fun, and I could walk the next day really easily. And I've been having some hamstring issues, so I didn't want to overexert myself.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would say, well, if you don't want to overexert yourself, don't do a marathon. But that's not really how the way my body works. I like feel better like the week after I do a marathon than
right.
if I don't. It's really weird, but
yeah, it's been like 3 days now and I'm feeling great.
Yeah.
I was really sore the next day. Well, we had to drive in the car for like 10 hours, which is not the best way to spend your time, you know, recovering from a marathon. But
yeah, you should do as much moving around as you can. But typically the week after your marathon, you want to take it really easy, you know, get good low impact exercise, but don't be doing a lot of intense stuff.
When we came close to the finishing line, I noticed they had a live band and things were all, you know, festive. You run across the bridge and then you're in downtown Missoula and the finishing line's right there. I didn't really look too carefully what was going on around me. I just focused on finishing as quickly as I could. And when I finally got through the finishing area and they put the medal around my neck and I got to walk, I was so tired. I just wanted to find a place to sit down. And the post-race food was pretty good. They were serving watermelon and bananas and a lot of other stuff, but I took a piece of watermelon and it must have been the best watermelon that I've ever had.
It did taste really good. It was sweet, cold, crisp. It was just like, oh,
yeah,
manna from heaven.
Yeah, it wasn't because it was actually intrinsically good or better than any watermelon I've had, but eating a piece of watermelon after running in the sun for 26 miles, it just ups the experience so much.
For me, I think eating anything, it's like, obviously there's some things I shy away from, like, I don't even touch dry bagels, it's like, you know, yuck. Or usually, like, any kind of bar type things they have, I avoid.
But yeah, packaged
fruit,
stuff.
You know, I love chocolate milk, they had cheese sticks, they had these really good frozen fruit puree bars, those mm-hmm. were good, really good. Some trail mix, it was really good. So yeah, I'm all about the food. It was cool, too, when you crossed the finish line, they announced your name and your hometown.
Right.
And they said to me, they're like, oh, here's a maniac. How many marathons have you done? So I held up my hand in 5, 10, 15, and then 2. So he's like, 17. Oh, I can read sign language. It was kind of cool.
So they get your hometown pronounced correctly?
No, they said Sixton, Missouri.
Well, they did say it properly when I crossed. They said Sykeston.
Wow.
And I was kind of surprised because most people never heard of that place.
Yeah, I was running along the course. A lot of people would say, hey, where are you from, maniac? And I was like, Missouri, sort of, but originally from Montana. And I don't know, it's funny how I still feel like I don't identify totally with Missouri, even though we've lived there for almost 7 years.
I know, but Montana is one of those states where you get a lot more respect if you are one of them and you're from there.
Right.
So
yeah, I don't want to offend people from Missouri because it's a great state with a lot going for it.
Yeah, definitely.
But I don't know. I just, people ask me where I'm from. I'm like, well, I live in Missouri, but I'm from Montana. Maybe I have too much Montana pride. I don't know.
All the people that we met in Montana, when they, you know, they always ask you where you're from. And when we got to tell people that you were from Lewistown, and it's like there's more instant credibility that we have, you know. We're more worthy now to be there. It's kind of weird how it works up there.
Yeah, I think people typically identify with someone who has common life experience with them, I guess, probably.
Yeah.
And we were sitting around the finishing area eating our food, and kind of instantly, like a bunch of other marathon maniacs kind of like came and sat down, and we started talking with them. And I met this guy named Tom. He was from Hawaii, and that was his 163rd marathon. And what I thought was really, I said, wow, you know, you really have to travel to do these marathons. And I mentioned another maniac we know from Hawaii named Ed. And he's like, oh, yeah, I know Ed. So it was funny. He said he's done over 50 of his marathons, actually, in Hawaii.
Yeah, it was really funny how your marathon maniac shirt was like a beacon to draw in other marathon maniacs. And pretty soon there was like 7 of them sitting around us. And they were really fascinating people. One lady, I didn't remember her name now, but that was her 200th marathon there in Missoula.
Yeah, she was probably in her 60s, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so.
And she had done like 45 ultras,
mm-hmm.
500 milers. So it's like anytime I'm around people like that, I just feel like it's like so humbling because I feel like I still have so much to learn, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, there's so much more of running and life and marathons to experience. Maybe someday I'll be the 60-year-old woman sitting there being like, yeah, just ran my 200th marathon.
You know, something else cool about this race is the race pictures are free. You don't have to pay tons of money to order a copy or even a digital copy. That's new. I've never been in a race where they're free.
Yeah, that is pretty neat. So all the awkward pictures of yourself you can have for free instead of buy them. We need to do that sometime. Like on our Facebook page, we need to have people post their most awkward race photo. So anyway.
An awkward photo contest.
Yes, that would be cool. Awkward photo contest.
I think I could win that contest.
Yeah, especially when you have like your electrical tape taping your headphones to your ears.
My ears are like red and glowing in the sun.
But the funny thing is, you know, when you're running and you know you look horrible, you don't really care.
Afterwards, you do care, though, when you see yourself. You're like, I look like that?
I had dried snot in my nose? Oh, no.
So I thought the medal was pretty cool. It was kind of copper-colored, horseshoe-shaped, really big, and it had a nice ribbon.
Yeah, it was awesome. It's going to look great on my medal hanger.
We got invited to a party at John and Jill's house, the folks who let us stay in their vacation rental. And when we were out there, we got to meet some of the people who had run the half marathon that day.
People who had volunteered at the race.
Yes. As well as John and Jill's son, who is on the cross-country team at Hellgate High School in Missoula and is super fast. He actually finished 6th place at the half marathon that day. He's like, what, how old, 17?
I think he'll be a senior in high school, so he's starting to look at colleges. And
colleges are starting to look at him, and yeah, it's really neat. And actually, the race director is the running coach at the high school in Missoula, and he's also the owner of the local running store, Runner's Edge. And he sounds like an all-around neat guy. His name is Anders, and we were really close to getting to meet him. He came to the party right as we left, so we didn't quite cross paths soon enough.
Yes, we might have had some interesting tidbits to share about the race. So yeah, this is definitely a race that the marathon sells out. It's worth putting on your list to do. Definitely a well-recommended Montana marathon.
So since Missoula's in the mountains, I mean, it's not as high as other races that are going on, but it's at more altitude than what we live at, we decided that we would put in here something for you about how to train for altitude. So, Angie, how does one train for altitude?
Well, I was actually asked this week on our Facebook page how I trained for the altitude of this race, and it kind of made me think, well, I didn't train for the altitude of this race. Maybe that's why my finishing time sucks so much. But the start of the race was at 3,045 feet, and we live and train at 328 feet. So we're talking about approximately 3,000 feet difference. And I really don't train on hills very frequently either, unlike Trevor, who does more trail running. And so I definitely felt the change in elevation. I felt more short of breath, like I wasn't getting as much oxygen. And like Trevor said, there are obviously races that start at much higher elevation, like, you know, the Pikes Peak Marathon, which starts at, I think, over 6,000 feet. In fact, it's technically not even considered high altitude unless the elevation is over 4,900 feet. But, you know, tell that to my body. So if you live at elevation, you actually have a physical advantage in preparing for races. Your body is actually adapted to performing on less oxygen. And when you get to lower climates, it'll feel like you're breathing liquid fastness.
So that must be the Kenyan advantage. A lot of those guys live around mountains.
Right. Many elite runners either live at altitude or they train there for a significant portion of their training. Places like Boulder, Colorado, Flagstaff, Arizona, Mammoth, California, those are very popular kind of running meccas.
Oh, we might ought to add Ashland, Oregon. There's a lot of ultra runners there. Timothy Olson, who we mentioned earlier, won Western States. I think he's from Ashland.
That's true, yes. Yeah, I was reading that 95% of Olympic medalists and world champion runners since 1968 either live or train at altitude. They often follow the directive to live high and train low. And there's a number of physical reasons for this.
Now, what do you mean live high, train low?
I mean, live at high elevation, then train at a lower elevation. So, you know, you live high, your body adapts to the less oxygen. It goes through the physiologic changes, but then do your marathon pace runs at a lower altitude. So it's kind of interesting. We'll go into a little bit of the physiology of it. But the human body is really very adaptable, but it performs best at sea level. The concentration of oxygen at sea level is 20.9%, and that leaves the hemoglobin, or that oxygen-binding red pigment in your blood, at full saturation. Above 4,900 feet, or 2,000 meters, that's where the measurable differences in oxygen saturation can actually be measured. So if you're doing any kind of endurance event at high altitude, you're going to notice a significant difference in your pace, your energy, and probably your endurance. The underlying difficulty with high altitude is that there's less oxygen. And while this may not pose a problem if you're just driving to high altitude or you're just resting, if you're an athlete, it's going to pose a challenge. In general, the higher the altitude, the longer it takes to adapt. And if you understand the adaptation process, there really are things you can do to have an easier transition. Some of the changes take place in a matter of days, while others are going to require several months. Some studies find that most adaptation will take place within 21 to 28 days. So the first thing that happens at altitude is that your respiratory rate and your heart rate speed up at both rest and exercise. So you'll notice that you're breathing faster and your heart rate may seem like it's beating faster. This helps to offset the lower partial pressure of oxygen, and you're not going to be able to reach your maximum VO2 while you're at altitude if you're new to it. Greg McMillan, an exercise scientist, says, immediately upon arrival at altitude, the kidneys react to send more erythropoietin, or EPO, to the bone marrow, which produces new red blood cells to carry more oxygen. This process is helpful for the distance runner, but requires no training at all. You just need to go to altitude. But you need to be careful when you're going to train at altitude. Most athletes make kind of a mistake when they arrive at high elevation. They train too hard too soon. And McMillan goes on to say that this robs the body of the energy it needs to complete the process of creating more red blood cells and shifting more fluid into the blood to balance the increase in red cell mass. So there's a lot of changes going on in your body when you first arrive at altitude. And if you train really hard at first, it's going to interrupt those adaptation processes. Many runners will experience a headache, poor sleep, and sometimes gastrointestinal issues during the first few days in the mountains. So one way to offset that is to take it easier and to focus on proper hydration. Longer-term changes at altitude include a decreased maximum heart rate, increased number of red blood cells, and chemical changes in the red blood cells that make it easier for oxygen to get to your tissues, and an increase in the number of mitochondria and oxidative enzymes. So your body can adapt very well, but it does take a while.
So it sounds like we need to start living at altitude.
Yeah, and actually there's some debate about what is the best altitude to live at. Some people say it's between 7,000 to 8,000 feet.
Man, it's up there.
That's pretty high. I think Flagstaff, Arizona is at 7,000 feet.
I think the highest point in Missouri is Mount Tom Sock, which I have climbed the top of.
Bravo.
And that is 1,700 feet.
Right.
So here are some ways to help with the adaption process. Angie has, what, three suggestions?
Four? Yes.
She has three suggestions plus one bonus suggestion.
Oh, okay. The first one has to do with your diet. Consume a clean and balanced diet to aid in recovery and to help with better performance. Some experts suggest increasing the amount of healthy carbohydrates that you eat, consuming more iron to help with that red blood cell production, and lowering your salt intake, which will leave you at less risk of mountain sickness. Many athletes find that they have a decrease in appetite at altitude, and if you don't eat enough, you're going to have some resulting loss of muscle mass that's going to hinder your performance. Like they find people who are trying to climb Everest, you know, they make them go to different base camps to try to adapt. And when you're really high elevation, your appetite just is shot. And many of these people will lose just a significant amount of weight while they're up there because the body has to work so hard just to maintain its normal daily functions. And if you're not eating enough to offset that, it really, you know, can significantly decrease your performance. So you also want to avoid alcohol and caffeine while you're at altitude, and focus on drinking extra water to counterbalance the cool, dry air.
You know, I went on a hike in the Andes Mountains in the country of Bolivia, actually, and we were at like 12,000 feet, and a nature guy, friend of mine who was I was with, told me to eat really slow, just nibble on food, because you can get just a split headache, an altitude headache from eating too fast and diverting too much blood away from your brain, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you don't want to mess around with altitude. I mean, it is, you got to respect it.
That's right. The second adaptation tip has to do with your workout intensity. You're going to want to lower your intensity during the adaptation period. Train and race by effort. You really need to tune into your body and pay attention to your breathing rate. So if you feel like you're not getting enough air, if you're breathing more rapidly, you definitely need to slow down your pace, even if, you know, you're running way slower than you normally are used to. If you try to train only by your pace, you're going to overstress your body and cause long-term damage. And make sure that you keep a training log if you're working at altitude, just to monitor your morning resting heart rate, the fatigue you feel after a workout, your weight, and your mood. In relation to your training, if you are going to be training for a race at altitude, you want to try to simulate the course and the altitude. Olympic coaches Keith and Kevin Hansen are known for preparing their athletes for competition by simulating every inch of the course. So you're going to want to review your target race course and train for it specifically. If it's hilly, you find out the grade and run repeats or tempo runs on those type of hills or on the treadmill. If it's going to have a lot of sharp turns, try to run a course with turns. If it's a flat course, you know, run flat training runs. Just simulating the course is going to help you prepare your body for the specific demands, as well as give you a mental edge. So if you're preparing for altitude, it helps to run in the heat of the day when your body is going to have to work harder to cool itself. You can run into the wind for added resistance. And obviously, hill workouts are going to be a big part of your training as well. If you live above 6,000 feet, you should try to drive to lower elevations for a few marathon-paced long runs. And that'll just help your body tune in to what pace you're going to run when you're down at a lower elevation. Those from lower elevations that are preparing for high-altitude races should get up high for a few training runs if possible. And high-intensity hill workouts can also help you get used to being oxygen-deprived. Because when you're running up a hill, you know, your body is working so much harder, you feel like you're sucking air, and your heart rate's going to be increased. Some people, if they have extra money to spend, they go to running camps at altitude for a few weeks. From 1 to 3 weeks can be of benefit before your goal race. Just make sure you do this under the direction of a running coach so that you get the most benefit out of your workout. When it comes to the race itself, you really have to create a new elevation standard. You can't look at your previous PR from a flat course at lower altitude, because that's not going to work for a race at altitude. Don't go into a high-altitude race with a pace or a finish time in mind. This is going to decrease the stress of trying to keep that certain pace during the race, which is going to, you know, possibly hinder your performance. Try to arrive early to the race, and if at all possible, invest in a few days of living at that altitude before you actually run your race. That'll allow your body to get used to some of the stress of living at altitude. Some people say at least 3 days or more is preferable. Finally, be realistic about your goal time. Lower your goal time by 30 seconds per mile for a flat course above 5,000 feet, and even more for a hilly course. So it is possible to successfully train at lower altitude and run a high altitude race, but you just have to really focus in on some key factors to prepare your body.
You know, I think we should try running a high-altitude race.
Pikes Peak Marathon, here we come.
This is like straight up and then straight down.
Right.
All right, so there's a little bit about training for a race at altitude. Now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And this is going to be very simple. This is maybe the stupidest quick tip we've ever done.
Kind of like one of those duh things.
And this episode's quick tip is about drinking water. We advocate it. No. This has happened to us now at a couple races, Angie, where it's the night before the race. We're getting our shirt out. We're getting our race bib out, putting our race bib on our shirt with safety pins in our swag bag from the race expo. There's like no safety pins, or there's maybe one. And you can't affix a race bib to a shirt with one safety pin very well.
Well, it would flap around annoyingly for 26 miles. Right. So I'm sure if this has happened to us a couple of times, that it's obviously happened to other people too.
We always have to scrounge around for safety pins. This time we had to end up asking your mom so we could each get by. But what were we going to do without them, you know? Because, like, tape the bib to our chest.
Right. Staple it. Ching, ching.
We didn't have any tape.
Right. So our quick tip is have a few safety pins in your luggage, in your purse, somewhere that goes to the marathon with you. So in case you don't get any at the race expo, or you can be smart and check while you're at the expo to make sure you have safety pins, and then track down said person who's supposed to be distributing them.
I had one safety pin in my packet.
I had zero. So we had to come up with seven.
So whatever you have in your hands right now, set it down. If it's a baby, hand it to somebody else.
If you're driving a car, just keep driving.
Go get some safety pins and put them in your purse, put them in your car, your wallet, your race bag. You'll be thankful that you did.
Or you can buy one of those belts where you can attach your race bib to it.
Yeah, but that's only for studly guys who run without their shirts.
Oh, really? Okay, then.
I usually leave my shirt on. So safety pins, that's the quick tip for today. You got to bring them. You kind of have to have them.
That's right.
We haven't figured out any other way around them. And if you'd like more information on running and marathon training, visit us at marathontrainacademy.com. And when you're on our website, you can read over the blog post that goes along with this episode, as well as download a free audio gift called The 7 Pillars of Successful Marathon Training. Thank you for being part of our listening audience. We want you to know you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way.